Good morning. My name is Mark Weissman. I am here appearing before you representing the appellant, Wayland Security. Wayland has, in this case, appealed a grant of a motion for summary judgment, which was awarded in favor of the respondents and against my client. This case involves a non-compete agreement. The primary issue in this case is the reasonableness, the facial validity, if you will, of a non-compete agreement that Mr. Kennebrew signed. This was an agreement that Mr. Kennebrew signed at the very inception of his employment with Wayland, and it involves non-competition and non-solicitation covenants that are set forth in paragraph 3. Let me briefly go over with you what these covenants are. They are for 2 years that prohibit the solicitation of Wayland's customers, the solicitation or employment of his employees, or the work for a competing company within a 50-mile radius of where Mr. Kennebrew worked Wayland.
But the 50-mile limitation is only for where he can work. The limitation on customer solicitation is nationwide, regardless whether he had contact with those customers.
Is that correct? It is without a geographic restriction, Your Honor. That is correct.
And it's not limited to people he had contact with.
Is it correct? Not on its face. No, it is not.
And it covers prospective customers who were being sought in the last 12 months also.
The non-compete says that he won't solicit our customers or solicit those customers whose business we were seeking within the last 12 months.
Okay.
And the statement you made, it's not just their current customers, but it's anyone they were attempting.
Let me read you the language specifically. It says, or prospective customers whose business was being sought during the past 12 months of the employee's employment. So in other words, if we are actively working to get a client in the door, okay, we don't want you to basically march right up to the altar with this client.
No, but this isn't, I understand, this is not limited to people he was soliciting. It's anybody in the company was soliciting.
Who the employer was soliciting.
Yeah, so
that
how,
is correct.
Can you tell me, because the cases that I haven't seen a similar case which had a clause which with a company that was located in multiple locations prohibited them from soliciting customers, existing or future customers, nationwide, as this does.
I'm sorry, was that a question?
Yes, it was. Looking at the cases, I didn't find one that was comparable. I found ones that had broad non-solicitation clauses, but they were local companies, and the national companies had narrower ones. This seems to be a national company.
We are not a national company in the sense that we are nationwide. We do have businesses in mm-hmm. St. Louis, in Houston, and some other areas, okay? But we are not
Tennessee and Texas, and I don't know, how many states do you have?
I believe it is 23 states.
23 states, okay.
Can you tell us what the facts are regarding Park Square?
Yes, I can.
Because he was based in Dallas, but did Mr. Kennebrew have responsibilities in the Houston
area? Yes, he did. He did work for us in Houston.
Didn't he get located in Dallas precisely because there was a non-compete in
Houston
and he couldn't work in Houston?
But it was only a six-month non-compete. Okay. We had to keep him out of Houston for 6 months.
So after 6 months. Okay.
He did work for us there. Okay.
Park Square was an actual customer, not one that you
absolutely.
Were,
okay. We had been dealing with Park Square, Mr. Kennebrew knew of or had a relationship with Park Square from a prior employer. I believe it was Allied Barton, but I'm not entirely certain of that. But the point was that Park Square was an existing client of ours, okay, during the time that Mr. Kennebrew worked for us, okay?
And he worked in the Houston area where that client was.
Yes.
What did he do in the Houston area?
He was working with us, having contact with our customers. What he said in his deposition as part of the record is that he assisted in Houston, including contacting former clients. He doesn't recall exactly whom, but he does recall contacting
them. He says he did contact clients, not just that he gave names of 10 former clients, but he says he actually.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
And he notes that he was successful in moving customers in Houston to Wayland. And from his deposition, he said they used me to get customers that I already had a relationship with. We hired Mr. Kennebrew not to be a security guard, but because he had an outstanding reputation as being someone that could develop business for us within particularly the Houston market. So the idea was we didn't want to violate his non-compete. We wanted to make sure that we respected, I believe it was Allied Barton's non-compete, okay, keep him out of there, and then let him go back and go into Houston. And so that's what he did for us.
What your non-compete clause that you had him sign is obviously far, far broader. Are you asking us to limit its application to the areas in which he actually worked for the company and solicited clients?
The agreement specifically includes a provision that if a court should decide that it is overly broad, that it could be restricted to the area in which the court finds it to be reasonable. In fact, we did ask the court below to modify the agreement.
What authority do courts have to rewrite the agreement?
She would not have to rewrite the agreement. The agreement simply said would have to say, look, if we want you not to solicit, not to compete with us in Houston, that's not a rewrite of the entire agreement.
But even a portion of it. I mean, do we have authority to do that?
The agreement.
Did you say there was something in the agreement that said you can do that?
Yes.
What clause was it?
Paragraph 6, dealing with divisibility, and if I can read it to you, it says, if any one or more of the provisions contained in this agreement shall for any reason be held to be excessively broad as to time, geographical scope, activity, or subject, it shall be construed by limiting and reducing it so as to be enforceable to the extent compatible with applicable law. This is in the agreement that he signed. There is also a provision dealing with severability that says, in the event that any one or more of these provisions is held to be invalid, illegal, or unenforceable, then the remaining provisions continue on. This is not a case in which we terminated Mr. Kennebrew. The court below placed much reliance on a case, Payroll Advance versus Yates. This is a different case. The agreement is different. Ms. Yates was terminated. We didn't terminate him. We adhered entirely to our agreement with Mr. Kennebrew. He was the one who decided, I want to go off and do something else. And so we believe it is entirely appropriate that he be held to the bargain that he made. But at this point, let me go back to what brought us to the appellate court to start with, okay? Was that the lower court said that the agreement as written is unreasonable. And I submit to you that the provisions in this agreement, within the four corners of this agreement, are reasonable under well-established Missouri law. 2 years, 50 miles, don't solicit our customers, don't solicit our employees.
There's no Missouri case that is approved. Don't solicit our customers, don't solicit our employees nationwide. The only one you cite had to do with a local business, so it doesn't really talk about anything like this. It may or may not be good policy, but there's no case that supports it. This goes beyond that.
There is certainly case law, at least I believe that there's case law that says that customer non-solicitation agreements, okay, are enforceable, okay, without a geographic jurisdiction. That is an alternative method for dealing with a non-compete. But let me also go back and emphasize that this case didn't arise in a vacuum. It arose with regard to specific allegations of this petition.
Is it really just this one Park Square customer that's it? I mean, I know we're dealing with a much broader clause, but is that the major client that was taken in the basis of
the case? The major issue that brought this case forward is that this was a customer of ours, okay, good customer, and
is there a claim below of other customers in Houston or elsewhere who were, are there claims related to other locations?
All of the allegations deal with Houston at this point, okay? We fought long and hard during the discovery process about whether he had dealt with other customers. And frankly, I don't want to go into all of the details at this point, but the argument was that we didn't, at least he tried to make the argument, that we didn't have the right to inquire about other customers because it would have violated the confidentiality agreements that he had with his own company, Elite, and we fought back and forth. Suffice it to say that we think he did contact other customers of ours, but what we do know is that he contacted and actually dealt with Park Square.
And this was a summary judgment grant?
Yes, Your Honor.
For him.
This was a summary judgment that was entered into in Mr. Kennebrew's favor. And I would emphasize also that it was done after a preliminary injunction hearing. This was not the permanent injunction hearing.
Can you clarify that for me? It sounds like there were three TROs. How long did those last?
There were
I was unclear about the June to September. Were there 6 months when he could not compete, or was it just 3 months, or what exactly?
We originally filed the lawsuit in January of 2010. Okay, there were temporary restraining orders that were entered into January 13th, February 20th, and March 15th.
And did they just last for a month each, or how long?
They were 30 days each, I believe.
So what happened from April to September?
There was nothing in port. And then what happened was we started the preliminary injunction, I believe, in June, for reasons that I don't think are relevant at this point. We were unable to complete them in June. We resumed it in July, preliminary injunction hearing. Okay, we didn't complete it then. We ultimately completed the preliminary injunction hearing, I believe it was in early September, okay? Now, not to try a preliminary injunction hearing. And so that was the posture of the case.
What does the case law say about how you're claiming a two-year bar? What about the time prior to the 3 or 4 months before you filed suit, and then obviously, assuming we were to find some sort of bar, he would get credit for the time and a preliminary injunction was in place? What does the case law address about the time before you?
I believe the case law says that we could be entitled in the court's discretion to a preliminary injunction from the date of any decree that is entered in the case. The Court of Appeals below said that they would not enter in an additional injunction because the injunction period had expired, but that we were not without a remedy because we did have the right to damages for that period of time.
And how do you address that?
I believe that we are still entitled to the benefit of our bargain, which was that we were entitled to a two-year period when he wasn't competing with us.
Because at this point, Park Square is not your client and has been a client of this other company for 2 years, so how would an injunction aid your client?
Well, what we don't know is we don't know whether or not Park Square would have continued to do business with us, notwithstanding their express reservations.
Yeah, but we're not talking about back then. We're talking about, and we're assuming you were to win below after
they
a
might
trial
continue,
if we were to
they might, we might be able to win them back. We certainly lobbied to get them back after we lost the client. I see that my time is up, and I would like to reserve a little bit more time for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the three separate covenants at issue in this case either were invalid on their face or under the undisputed material facts of this case were inapplicable to Mr. Kennebrew. Under either theory, the trial court's summary judgment for Mr. Kennebrew should be affirmed. Now, as Mr. Wiseman pointed out, there are three separate covenants, and I think that's very important. The first one says that Mr. Kennebrew can't work within 50 miles of a 50-mile radius of any location where he had provided or arranged for Whelan's services. Now, that's invalid because it has no geographical focus. It has no actual practical geographical focus. And second, it's inapplicable.
50 miles of where? Say that again. 50 miles of wherever he had worked for.
Provided or arranged for employer to provide services.
And that's without geographical restriction?
In this case, under the facts and circumstances of this case, yes. As they admitted in their opening, Whelan has 38 offices in 23 states.
And it's not limited by places that he performed or did services for the company?
Yes, it is. But the way Whelan is trying to apply this is without limitation.
Well, what about if they just apply it to Houston? Is that a place where it would be applicable if we found
Houston
it valid?
Houston and Dallas.
We would not dispute that this applies in Dallas. If the language
right.
is to be construed so as to make it reasonable, it would apply in Dallas because that's the only place he actually provided services or arranged for services.
He didn't do anything in Houston?
Wouldn't there at least be a disputed fact whether or not he was doing business in Houston?
It's not a disputed fact because in the summary judgment context, when Mr. Kennebrew in his summary judgment motion, his statement of uncontroverted facts, says that that he didn't do any work in Houston. It's up to them to actually show conclusively that he did. The problem with their argument...
What did they say in response?
Well, they suggest, without actual evidence, that...
Well, do they have an affidavit?
From their CEO. But the problem is their CEO, Mr. Twardowski, contradicted himself
If he contradicted himself, the trial court could believe it or not believe it. But at the summary judgment stage, we're not determining credibility, are we?
No, we aren't determining credibility. That's very
so
true.
So why wouldn't it be a disputed fact whether or not he worked in Houston?
Because the actual... The only material evidence that was before the court was that he didn't actually do any work in Houston. I'll tell you why. He only provided... his superiors with a list of his own prior customer contacts so that Whalen's separate Houston office, and I think it's very important to note that Whalen had a separate office with a separate person in Mr. Kennebrew's exact position in Houston. He was the Dallas branch manager.
It doesn't require that he be physically located in a different office. It says where he provided or arranged for a provider to provide services. So him providing names of businesses to be solicited in Houston could fall under that, could it not?
If he had done so, but he... Well, no.
What did the CEO say that he did in Houston?
You're saying a list... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. It wasn't CEO. It was their vice president, Mike Porterfield. He claimed that Mr. Kennebrew, quote, on occasion had been called upon to support Houston sales or services. But when asked to... it's on pages 83 to 85 of the first volume of the transcript. But when actually asked to identify who those customers were, he couldn't. The problem is that under the law of Missouri... Whalen had to be able to identify what these customers were. It says that in their brief, for example, they say over and over again, citing to Mr. Twardowski's testimony that Mr. Kennebrew was the manager of Park Square's account. He was the manager, but not at Whalen. He was the manager at Allied Barton, beforehand.
But if their vice president said that he supported services in Houston and later said, I just can't remember who, why doesn't that go to the weight of his testimony? Not whether or not there's a disputed fact.
Because I don't think that's a genuine dispute, Your Honor.
It's a genuine dispute that he can't remember the names.
I think the issue at that point, in order to defeat summary judgment, and this is not the law of Missouri, I could simply get on the stand without any support whatsoever, not making for a genuine dispute, could say whatever I wanted.
Well, it may not support damages, but, you know, because you have to show specific business loss, but why isn't it enough to create an issue of fact as to whether some business was done there by him?
Because I don't believe it was. It's providing for or arranged for the employer to provide services. I think it's very important to note that in their reply brief, Whalen says that the agreement superseded all prior agreements. Superseded all prior non-compete agreements. There weren't right. obviously any prior ones. What it didn't supersede was his actual employment offer with Whalen, which outlined effectively his job description. His job description was to provide services in Dallas.
So he worked for Allied. Park Squares was a client of Allied.
Yes.
He brought Allied with him to Whalen.
No,
Your Honor. Allied's a separate company based in Houston.
No, it's a separate company he used to work for, but then he went to work for Whalen, and moved over with him to
There's no evidence that Park Square moved over with Mr. Kennebrew. In fact, the evidence was that Mr. Kennebrew had given his superiors Park Square's name, but then the Houston office actually took care of that. The evidence was that the only...
So if giving names were sufficient to be doing business in Houston, he would have been in violation of his non-compete from the beginning.
I suppose at that point he would be in violation of his Allied Barton non-compete at the very beginning.
Right.
But obviously that's not the construction anyone's trying to give us.
Well, let's go back for just a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
Trial court, you would agree the trial court has the, at least, discretion to modify the terms to make them reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, of course.
And when you say that it is unreasonable on its face, aren't you saying there's no modification that could ever be done?
All the case law about modification in this context is that it's a matter of the trial court's discretion. I'm unable to find any case in which a lack of modification was reversed, or in fact, a modification was reversed.
Assuming If there were a dispute of fact, if this court were to find there was a dispute of fact as to whether or not he undertook activities for the client in Houston, why wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion not to for him just to say, I'm not going to apply this clause anyplace, and I'm not why isn't 50 miles such a more reasonable within 50 miles of where he does business, and he did business in Houston, why isn't that a reasonable limitation if we were to find that he in fact did business in Houston, which I understand we need to look at the record and figure out who we agree with.
Sure. If you look at any single, in fact, every single case, and there's a dozen of them or so that Wayland cites in their brief about these kinds of radius clauses, every single one of them has an actual physical defined locus or focus that it's a point from. Or the issue of this wasn't an issue. You know, if it were 200 miles from St. Louis, as you see in some of them, or you know, 125 miles from Springfield or something like that, that's one thing. This is so amorphous.
But isn't your objection more hypothetical than real? I mean, if their argument was, well, he made calls and offered good suggestions to people in our 20 district offices, so he did business in all of those and he's barred in all of those, that would be one thing. But here they're saying, he made some calls or did some assistance for particular customers in Houston, his old area, and we want him barred from that area, and it's only Houston and Dallas. Why is there some law that says we look at it as applied, or do we look at it on its face, or do we look at it hypothetically, or do we just look at how, in fact, whether or not everybody can understand what it meant here, and was that reasonable?
I think in the context of these non-compete clauses, there are two steps to that analysis. The first step is always facial. On its face, is this reasonable or not? Missouri courts have held a number of different types of non-compete clauses to be facially unreasonable. In the payroll advance case, I think, is the most on point, because that also involved a 50-mile restriction without a focus point. And it was also a person.
Did that case involve a separate provision that, what you think about, is a severability provision or a modification provision?
It involved that as, in the modification part, in their argument, it didn't involve, I don't believe the contract itself had a paragraph 6 like
doesn't
this
that,
does.
Doesn't that make cases like this with a contract like that almost always disputed issues of fact as to what's reasonable?
I'm not aware of any other cases that are about a paragraph 6 like this one is. I don't think there is any actual case law about that. But I think it's still a matter. Sorry, Your Honor.
Payroll advance, he didn't work at each of those offices. Wasn't that the problem? It was within it. 50 miles of any office, regardless whether he worked there?
It said of the business. And if you read payroll advance, the business there, the employer there, argued that it meant only within this one, just like Wayland is arguing here. But the court said that, you know, reading it on its face, it would mean that they'd have to work, you know, they would have to be aware of what went on at each place, at each branch.
Okay.
I think payroll advance, just because of, and in fact, the Southern District there goes into a whole thing about the fact that there is no focus point, that all the other cases say, you know, when construing these radius clauses, there is some defined actual focus point.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
If the agreement said Dallas, Houston, Nashville, St. Louis, would there be a focus point?
If it physically said that?
The agreement says any place he works or procured business, words that effect, okay, out of their offices. But what if it just said Dallas, Houston, Nashville, St. Louis? Would you agree that there's a focus
point? At that point, I would agree there's a focus point, but then to go on with Judge Stitt's question, we would go to the next step of analysis, which would be under the facts and circumstances of this case, is this reasonable? Does this fit? If it said Dallas, Houston, Nashville, et cetera, and the guy had, in your hypothetical, had never worked in Nashville but decides he wants to move to Nashville and set up his own business, then, just as in this case, it would be unreasonable as well.
Given the contract, would it be unreasonable, or would there be a disputed issue of fact as to whether or not it's reasonable?
In Judge Beadham's hypothetical?
Right. Well, you went to the next step and
yes.
then assumed facts. My question is, when you go to the next step, do you assume facts or do you require proof as to what the facts really are?
I think it's plain summary judgment inquiry. You know, there has to be an undisputed material fact.
What if the employer says he worked there and he says he didn't?
It would depend on the – well, if you look at the summary judgment rule, it says in determining whether there's a genuine dispute of material fact, the trial court is to look at basically the whole file, all the papers of the parties in the case. In this
what if
context,
all they find is one person says, I didn't work there, and the other one person says he did work there?
In that hypothetical, which I stress is not the facts of this case, then, yes, there would be a disputed
fact. Well, they're saying he worked there. They're saying he worked in Houston, and you're saying he didn't.
They have a guy getting up on the stand without any support whatsoever
but
saying
he's under
that.
You say he can say whatever he wants.
Right.
He's under the laws of perjury. He can't lie.
You have to base it on personal knowledge. You're saying he didn't have any? Or
yes, that's exactly right. He had no personal knowledge of this. It's Mr. Porterfield was their VP of security operations here in St. Louis. He didn't have any personal knowledge of it, and the only parties who did have personal knowledge of it, including the actual manager of Park Square herself, who conclusively said, he didn't solicit me. I fired Whelan. In fact, Mr. Twardowski admits on the stand, pages 35 to 37 of the transcript, that she, yeah, the dates match up. She didn't contact Elite and Mr. Kennebrew until December of 2009, after she had already fired Whelan. There can't be a genuine dispute of material fact as to whether
should this court not agree with that and find there is a genuine disputed issue of fact, what is the test on remand that the trial court should apply in resolving that issue of fact, determining whether he did business and or under the terms whether he worked for competing business within a 50-mile radius of any location where he provided or arranged for employer to provide services? What is it meant by provided or arranged for employer to provide services? So how does the trial court determine
that's
that
a, that's a difficult question, Your Honor, and I think that goes to the heart of why there was summary judgment in this case. That you really don't, I mean, certainly if the court were to find that, we would be stuck with the plain language of the contract at issue, and you'd have to see what does that actually mean. Now, of course, being
just giving someone a list of customers in that area constitute providing or arranging for the employer to provide services?
I think people in Mr. Kennebrew's position who have these sort of managerial jobs where they brought their knowledge and their expertise from other jobs kind of expect that they'll be asked at some point, say, hey, do you know anybody in Nashville or Chicago or something like that? I don't think a reasonable person would interpret that as providing services in that other city.
As opposed to what if they contacted the customer themselves?
That might be different, but that there's no evidence that actually happened in this case.
And then finally, because your time is
yes, Your Honor.
2 seconds, but you can you address this issue of remedy? Should there the 2 years is gone, but what's the point of having a non-compete clause if you can't enforce it because of the length of the court process?
I understand that. Whelan in their reply brief for this proposition relies on furniture manufacturing and Willis. Furniture manufacturing is from the 80s. Whelan argues that these cases both flatly say enforcement of an injunction from the date of the decree isn't inequitable. It's not actually what they say. In a case like this where the employer is claiming both damages and an injunction, what furniture manufacturing and then Willis following it do is they give the employer a choice on remand. If they want to elect to continue pursuing their damages claim for the very reason you identified when questioning Mr. Wiseman before, if they want to go with damages, they can't go with an injunction. If they want to go with an injunction, they can't go with damages. It's because damages are obviously a legal remedy, injunctions obviously an equitable remedy, and they conflict at that point. Furniture manufacturing addresses that. I think the court in the bizarre circumstance where it actually did that could give the trial court that choice, but no more.
Thank you.
We would ask you to affirm the trial court's judgment.
Let me just address a few points in rebuttal. First of all, the distinction between a post office address and a radius address, as in our agreement, to me is a distinction without a difference. I think it is very clear that we are talking about a very fixed point on a map, and trying to say that because it doesn't say 210 South Doe Street is a distinction without a difference. The evidence is certainly disputed, although we believe it is clear on the other side, that this man worked in Houston for Whalen. Mr. Twardowski specifically testified about this, and he said he was actively involved in the management of the Houston office. At the very least,
do you have to have a personal information for that, or some basis, or can somebody just say something?
I mean,
an affidavit, certainly you have to have a personal
knowledge.
This is
what he testified to, okay?
I understand.
Okay. He's the CEO and the president. I mean, he has reason to know what is going on within his own business. But I would submit to you that Mr. Kennebrew, in his own deposition, told us what he was doing. He said that he was working in Houston.
So it was an undisputed fact? Is that your position?
I don't remember specifically whether I put that in there, but it was certainly a disputed fact. We thought that we had established that he had, in fact, worked in Houston. Okay? The agreements that we're talking about have to be reasonable as written. They don't have to be immune from any hypothetical attack. I submit to you that there is no non-compete agreement that someone cannot factually come up with.
Well, what if this court were to find that some or all of the provisions were not reasonable as written, but could be narrowed? Or, I mean, if they're unreasonable as written, do we throw it out entirely?
I certainly think that there is room to modify this agreement. I mean, certainly to say that someone, if he worked in Dallas or he worked in Houston and we say, don't go after our clients for 2 years within 50 miles of where you worked for Whalen, that would certainly be a modification.
That is, when you're talking about Dallas, which has a huge geographic area, I mean, wouldn't it need to be narrowed to where the office is or the Dallas? Goes out
it's
the
just
airport.
Where he worked. I mean,
50 miles from Dallas metropolitan area or something like that. I don't know.
We want to draw a pinpoint around Whalen's offices in Dallas or Houston. I suppose we could draw the circumference from there. But I mean, I think the agreement says within 50 miles of where he worked for Whalen.
So far as the records show, his new business was only in Houston.
It was only in Houston, and that was the other point I wanted to briefly address. We have never said that he couldn't work in Houston. We specifically told him, you can go after work that we're not in the market of getting. And so I think we are entitled to the benefit of our bargain in this case. The court should find the agreement as reasonable as written.
I think do you believe there are any cases, your opponent argues there are no cases where a trial court has been reversed for abusing its discretion and choosing not to modify an overly broad.
I am unaware of a case that is factually similar to ours. I am not aware of any case in which a court has thrown out a non-compete agreement of this type on the basis that I've read the agreement, it's unreasonable as written, and I'm throwing it out.
Thank you.
Thank you.